Hey, Yoni.
Hey, Jessica, what you drinking?
Water. What are you drinking?
Lemonade.
We have lost our kiddish spark. Well, no. Yoni, no. Welcome to the Kiddish Book Club.
L'chaim.
L'chaim.
I did clink my glass to the camera. Did you catch that?
I did catch that. I was like, I should do that, but I think I would knock my computer out with my big water bottle.
I think we've discussed that, like, we drink when we're together, but since we're on Zoom, does it count to that we're together or not?
You know, I miss having a kiddush, not being at the kiddush.
Fair. That's fair.
Because like I would go to the bar. I would go straight to the bar at the kiddush and be like, I need some liquid courage before I can be in a room full of people.
That's fair. I actually, what I miss about kiddush is there's plenty of people who you casually see at kiddush that I'm not seeing right now because like we just don't circle around each other the same way, and I'm not going to necessarily like brave the rain to go and, you know, stand outside the sidewalk and chat with them.
Well, now we can have five people together outside if we're like being safe hanging out. So, yeah. And my kid is like, what do I do with four friends outside? I'm like, what do you mean? What do you do with four friends outside? Go play, be children. He kind of looked at me like, I don't know what that means anymore. I've lost my ability. He really is genuinely confused. I'm like, you should all ride your bikes somewhere together and have fun.
Wait, like, what if we play video games?
Yeah, these like, but can we all play video games together? I'm like, but you used to like it. So that's where we are. We have hit peak, like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you baking sourdough?
I am not baking sourdough.
Okay, that's fair.
Are you baking sourdough?
No, I keep children, dogs, and plants alive. I do not need to keep sourdough alive.
Oh, see, I only keep the children alive. The plants die. So.
Right. Yeah.
I don't bother with those. I am like not taking on any new projects. I'm not like decorating or organizing or cleaning or building anything or growing anything or adopting any dogs. My life is exactly the same, but with three children in the house.
So I don't want to call it hoarding, but I've gotten a bit of a panic book collecting thing going on where I keep thinking I'm going to run out of books, and so then I keep acquiring more books.
Me too. And then I look at the pile and I'm like, how did it get so tall?
Yeah, and like three people want to return books to me, and I'm like, oh no, not all at once. Oh no.
Oh, I have a big stack to return to you.
Yes, everyone does, and I have this empty bookshelf behind me, but it's not going to be for very long if I keep this up.
Well, I just realized that I borrowed a book from another friend and I just started reading it this Shabbat and it was awesome. I halfway through already, called The Library Book by Susan Orlean. Have you read it yet?
No, I have not. What's it about?
Oh, so it's nonfiction, but as you read it, you're like swept away. It is about the Los Angeles library fire of 1986.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
Yes, it burned, I think, 500,000 or more books. Oh, and because the building was like made of stone and the way it was working was the library stacks ran up and down the center and they were in these airtight spaces to preserve old books, old, old patents, old architecture plans. Like basically there was a whole bunch of stuff that was old that was in these airtight areas. So once the fire got into those and it was no longer airtight, what ended up happening was it was kind of like a perfect environment for fire. And the firemen said that the fire was burning so hot and so perfectly that it was blue. Like when you're in a chem lab and they light the little burner and it's blue because it's like the perfect fire. They said this entire library on the inside, but the building wasn't burning down because it wasn't made of anything that would burn down. But all the windows were popping from the flames and the firemen could only be in there 10 minutes at a time. And it went on for, I think it was like 7 hours, but it's really good. I'm like totally swept away.
So ironically, I'm also reading a library related book. So I'm reading a book called The Overdue Life of Amy Byler. It's by Kelly Harms, and it's about a single mom who's a librarian whose husband had walked out. Like, he did that thing where he went for milk and never came back. But he actually moved to Hong Kong. And so he's come back and he wants to spend some time with his kids who are now teenagers. And so she goes to New York to a library convention and like starts living some of the freedom that she hasn't had in years and years and years because she's been single momming it up. So it actually is really, really, really good. And
it
there's
sounds really good. I wonder, I've heard good things about this book.
So there's a bit of, there's some email or not email, sorry. Specifically letters from her daughter or journal letters from her daughter interspaced within some of the chapters that kind of foreshadow some things that are going down while she's out of town. And so I'm kind of excited, but her daughter's like, I can't believe you're making me journal my reading. This is the worst. Why can't I read Outlander instead of this stupid book you want me to read or something? It's very cute.
Well, so the word for that is epistolary, right? Epistolary books are books that include lots of letters and journal entries.
Yeah, so this one is, it's not completely made out of letters or journal entries, but it has them to start off several sections. Like it'll have a little one just giving a blurb of what her daughter's doing. Anyway, I'm enjoying it. It's very cute.
What book was like that? Was Where Did You Go, Bernadette? I love books with the names of the female character in the title.
It's a thing.
It is. It's totally a thing. Like the Eleanor Oliphant one. I mean, come on. So Where Did You Go, Bernadette is also epistolary, but it's made up of like emails.
Yes.
Right. Right. Yes. Did you read it? You did read it.
So I tried to read it twice. I could not get into it. I could not. I just couldn't make it work. I know our friend Megan is reading it right now and she's loving it. So it's a likable book. It just somehow did not do it for me.
You know, this is so interesting because we were just talking privately before about, books that other people like that you don't like, right? Like, and how it's totally subjective and that's okay. Cause not every book is for everybody. So what have you tried a genre or a book that you did not expect to like and liked it?
So I'll tell you that this might surprise you, but I only started liking romance novels very recently. I used to think that they were like, I used to spurn them. What? They were not real, like sci-fi. And, you know, I didn't read fantasy either. So around, I started reading romance and fantasy at the same time, but I used to only be hardcore sci-fi and mystery. I never read any of the other genres. So yeah.
So you literally picked up a book and were like, brand new genre. Is that because you work at a place where you got all these books?
I don't know how. I can't remember how I got started into it. I just know that I definitely, like, at one point I was like, these people are wearing, like, leather or, like, they're riding horses. Like, that's, you know, because some of the fantasy books, it just, you know, there's not even necessarily magical elements. It just takes place in, like, a knight's, or like a medieval setting. And so I'm like, no, that's not really for me. I like spaceships and aliens instead. And so I did that for years and years and years. So yeah, it was interesting because I don't know what mentally I thought about it. I just thought that they weren't for me.
You know, I think like when you go down to the bookstore, especially the bookstore nearest Third Place Books, and you see they have those tables in the front where it's recent paperbacks, bestsellers, and then sometimes they'll have three or four tables that are just one genre, right? Like all new nonfiction, or they'll have one table that's just dedicated to politics, or one table that's just food. And so you look at those tables because the covers are so pretty and they're facing up instead of on a shelf, right? It makes it easier to look through them quickly without wondering where you got it. Like you don't have to slide it back into a spot. Those tables actually help me pick books I never would have read way more because they're being pushed towards me. Like, look at this pretty display.
What's a genre or a book that really pushed you out of your comfort zone?
I think the first nonfiction book that I read that we talked about before, that nonfiction pushed me out of my comfort zone, because sometimes nonfiction can really be written in a way that's gripping and I can't stop reading. And even though the book Imagine by Jonah Lehrer was recalled by the publisher eventually because there was like some stories in there that were debatably not true, the book itself was written so enthrallingly that I couldn't put it down. And someone recommended Eric Larson. Right? You know, Eric Larson, he wrote Thunderstruck, right? So A Devil in the White City. His books, his nonfiction books, where you feel like you're reading fiction, but you're really not. Those are something that I've definitely gotten into that I never would have gotten into before. And then sometimes my dad will push a book towards me. He knows I don't really like what quote unquote men's fiction, right? Like these Clive Cussler, Nelson DeMille, Jeffrey Archers. And I did love Cain and Abel, but that's only because he passed it to me. And he's like, I know you don't like the genre, but everyone likes this. You will like this. And so when he hands me a book like that, I trust him and I'll try it.
Yeah, I actually, it's funny because I don't know what it was, but I did read a lot of the traditionally, you know, mainstream, I guess, male appealing authors, you know, Kellerman and Deaver and Cussler and Clancy and Ludlum and like
a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, not like a lot of them. If I find a genre and I find an author, I will read them till they die and stop writing books.
like Clive Cussler did last month.
And Ludlum, he died partway through, but then I think his son or someone picked up and finished some of his series. Yeah, so like I will read literally everything. So it's hard to get me to switch because I'm like, well, why would I take a chance on something new when I could pick up this book from this author that I know will be a safe bet? And it's maybe formulaic, but I know that I'll enjoy while I'm reading it, right? So it's hard to like push me into something that's new.
I think that's probably true. When I'm reading a really good book, what I want is more of that same kind of good book, right? Yeah. This actually is very relevant because a lot of the conversations that are happening literally right now, this moment in publishing, is diversity in publishing and the fact that even though it appears that more diverse people are writing books, the actual numbers of those books that are getting published hasn't really gone up that much, right? And the conversations that go on behind the scenes at the publishers are so mysterious, right? Like we don't know what they're talking about. And there's rumors that they're talking about, is the author well-spoken and attractive so we can put them on an author tour? Is the subject something that Oprah will sell in her book club or Reese Witherspoon, right? Yeah. Like the conversations are, is this similar to another book that made $1 million that's gonna have the same audience? So it ends up kind of being self-perpetuating that the numbers haven't gone up that much. But I find that when I'm picking up books like that are more diverse and I'm like, that was so refreshing, I would like some more of that. And then all of a sudden I discover this like rabbit hole of other books that have been out there this whole time that have never been pushed towards me.
I do appreciate that, you know, just through book Twitter, I'm filling my to be read queue with more diverse authors than I ever would have found otherwise, because when you search a list, and I was doing this before you and I were chatting, because I'm updating my Goodreads, back to my book hoard, you know, I like to organize them and sort them sometimes. So I was going through and like tagging them with different tags so I can find them better later. And so I noticed that if you go to like the best paranormal series or the best series, you know, you see a lot of the same books like
over and over again.
Yeah, over and over and over again. And I was like, oh, that's kind of boring. And I wouldn't find these new books or these new authors if I wasn't like going out to look for them, because if I was just passive, right? Like you and I have our joke about what should I read after Harry Potter? Well, okay. I mean,
anything.
Literally anything.
Literally any book in the store. You've already read those seven. There's now you can read anything you want. You're done.
Right. But it's like, oh, so, and I saw lists that were like, here's what to read after Harry Potter. And I'll tell you, first of all, like, is the you a 12-year-old boy or a 25-year-old woman or a 45-year-old man or a 67-year-old? Like, who's the you? Because the list they recommended for after you finish Harry Potter was a little eclectic from that point of view, because I'm not going to give my 12-year-old necessarily what was something on the list that was like, I don't know if that book is age appropriate for someone who just finished Harry Potter, right? Like, you know. But it's also like, yeah, but okay, but there was that time was like, oh, then there's Hunger Games and Divergent and yeah, okay, but you know what? That genre is so much more than that group of well-known authors. It's not to say it's not worth reading them, but there's more.
It should lead you down a path of discovering more books that are like, oh, I can find more books if I just look for them. And I think that also those lists of suggestions for what to read after Harry Potter are kind of weird because it's almost like they're based on when the books originally came out.
Yes.
And when
there have been no new books since then.
Right. And it's like, but also that they assume that you started reading it when you were 11 and finished when you were 18. And I'm like, well, no, my kid picked it up when he was 11 and finished the month later, like all of them, right? Like now he's still 11. What you got for him, you know?
It really may not be a great next book for an 11-year-old.
Correct. So I'm like, let's come up with book recommendations. It's more like, if you like, that's why I like the, when people are like, I'm really looking for something with witches and I'm really looking for something from a culture I've never seen before, because that would be kind of cool.
But it's also like, what kind of witches? Do you want happy witches that solve crimes? Do you want evil witches that boil children?
Love your witches that solve crimes.
Do you want witches that bake cupcakes? Do you want witches that sell shoes? I mean, there are, like, there's a diversity in there. Like, if you like, you know, your police procedurals or your cupcake baker, like, you could get a paranormal cupcake baker. You could get a, you know, a romantic one. I mean, I was just looking at His Majesty's Dragon. It's basically the Napoleonic Wars with dragons.
Oh.
So, you know, I love dragons. I'll read almost everything with dragons, but that book was slightly more, it's Naomi Novak. It's slightly more like, it's really about the war and the strategy. And, you know, they're like, oh, we intercepted this dragon egg that was on its way to Napoleon from China. Now there's like, you know, Euro-Chinese relations are on the line because we know they're helping Napoleon. And they're going to pretend that they weren't. And we have to pretend that we don't know that they were doing that. It was like this whole thing, espionage and whatever, and dragons.
I love books that have historical references that are really well researched. That's the thing. Is like, I love any book that is deeply set in history that I didn't necessarily know before.
Have you read Kindred? I think I may have asked you this before, about Octavia Butler.
No, but I shall. See, so, that's what that is.
Yeah, so that book, you know, and it's funny because I'll tell you, and I mean this very strongly, she is on the same par with Philip K. Dick for me, in that it's a very simple story. It wasn't, you know, outlandish. There weren't, you know, all kinds of things. And it wasn't the fantastical nature that was really the driving point. It was the psychological and interpersonal reactions to the time travel event, which I don't know if I can spoil it, but like, you know, so it's not a book about time travel. It's a book where a character time travels and then they have to be a person. And so, like,
well, how so do you like the time traveler's wife, which isn't really about time travel. It's about people. It's about romance. It's about acts. Like, because it's time travel is the vice that is used to show like how much he loves her.
But where the time traveler's wife, in my mind, I still have like a bit. It was bittersweet but sad. Octavia Butler and Philip K. Dick have like a gritty, don't look away from something because it's humanity. Like this is kind of a darker part of humanity, but it's, you have to take it with it, right? This is part of humanity. It is dark and kind of ugly, but you can't exercise it out. Like it is there, you know, you can't just look away. You have to live it.
I love that. You know, and people listening to us right now might be going, you know, I don't care about any of this. Just tell me if it's good or not. But here's the thing. Every single person has a different idea of what's good. So Outlander is a great example of that. I was like, at some point with Outlander, I was like, I really cannot read 20 more pages of the geography. I literally skipped those pages in Pride and Prejudice. I'm not reading it in Outlander. So why, you know, but someone else is like, give me more Outlander, give me more of the books, where I'm just like, oh, I'm fine with the TV show, even though when the show comes and they throw twists at you because it's different than the books, there's nowhere to look to predict what happens next. Like sometimes I'm like, what's going to happen? I better look at what the books say. And then I discover they're nothing like the books. So that's where there's a twist. But I don't like the books. Other people love the books and are like, what's wrong with you? How can you not love these? But that's the thing, is the reason we sit around discussing concepts in books and what the content of them is because everyone has a different opinion of what's good.
Right. And, you know, most of the time when, you know, I get together, we do talk about books. We talked about that, you know, just because a book is amazing and great, it could have, you know, a scene with some very triggering or very, I don't want to say
uncomfortable.
Not just uncomfortable, but we talked about, like, you know, brutality against children, rape,
right.
You know, neglect, severe neglect, like, those concepts. So even though the entire book is great and other people like just really like it, and it might be something you would like, you might avoid something because you're like, this, I know this topic is not okay for me.
It's so, kind of like when I was pregnant, I stopped watching ER with my first baby because I was like, I cannot watch kids die because kids always died on ER. I was like, I can't watch this anymore. I'm switching over to TLC and watching New Mommies. Like because there's sometimes when you are like, you know what, I'm having a really emotional time right now. I would just like to watch some Real Housewives, or I would just like to read a book that makes me forget that we're in quarantine, or makes me forget that my kids haven't been in school. Like, I, you know, sometimes you just want to feel like distracted because you spend all day thinking about and learning and thinking and learning and being part of the world's developments. And then you're like, I just want to pick up a book for an hour and rest. I need some rest. I need a mental rest. Everyone needs to reboot every day.
Exactly. You know, there was a gal in our favorite group, Olaf, who was saying that she was just getting into Stephen King's thrillers, not his horror, but his thriller. And, you know, I remember there were times when I loved those books, but I hesitate to recommend them now because I'm so different now. I don't even know if I recommend them, even though I was obsessed with them and used to read them nonstop. Because I think if I went back now, I wonder if it was before I got my empathy bone. And like, it was easier to detach and read about someone going through like that, you know, a psychological thriller or being stalked by a scary car or something when you can't empathize with them. And now I'd be like, oh my, I don't think I like this. It is, I feel unsafe.
Yeah. It's sometimes you want to read a book to escape and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you want to read a book to delve more into a topic or a culture. One book that I loved last year that I think I've recommended before was Homegoing by Yagi Yasi. And I think I've passed it around to people. I was like, read Homegoing. It's so good. It really was that good. Yagi Yasi wrote it. Everyone loves family sagas, right? Family sagas where it goes from generation to generation to generation, and then it bounces around so you can see what each generation is going through, but you're reading them all at the same time. So this does this with Africa, and it starts with, I believe, slave castles, which I never heard. I didn't know what a slave castle was before. And then I read, I didn't know that they were like, that they were kidnapped and kept in these castles on the coast before they were shipped away, and that these castles were like these awful places before they even got on. I had never heard of them, and that they're still sitting there, places that you can see. And so seeing that right from the beginning, I was like, this is so good. And what's crazy is, again, I'm not going to recommend it to people because, oh, you'll learn something. I like learning things in books. I like learning history that I didn't know before about other people and their cultures. I like that. But it was also just really good. It was just a really well-written book. And so the combination of the two things, highly recommend Homegoing.
Yes. I actually, one thing I'm really enjoying, you know, because I mentioned that I really enjoy sci-fi and now I'm really getting into fantasy. And there are some books that I appreciate where, you know, I'm sorry, when aliens come, they're not going to land in the middle of New York City. There's a very equal chance they're going to be in Australia or Spain or China. Yeah. Like, it's just silly. So I like reading books that are like, that are centered around not America, because it's just more interesting. Like, there's so many stories where it's, you know, American or Eurocentric. So there's a few, you know, like We Hunt the Flame, you know, we mentioned before by Hafsa Faisal, where it's a fantasy novel, but it really is more of a, like a Middle Eastern, Arabian, fantasy with sand and the mythological creatures that haunt the sand and, you know, the assassins and that kind of thing. And I read another one called Tears and Rain, which is, it takes place in Spain, and it has, you know, a different way of looking. So that when they describe a city, it's new to me, because I've been to Spain once, but it's, you know, it's nice to hear like, oh, there's just aliens walking down the street in Madrid, and this is what Madrid looks like, and here's how the apartment buildings are there, and like all that stuff. It kind of adds to the world building for me, because it is something different. It's like, well, why not read stories from that point of view? So, you know, going out and finding whatever genre you're looking for, you can find different cultures who have kind of imbued it with their own.
Oh yeah, no, it's really not hard if you're looking for it to go, I would like to read a book that is set in Australia. Go, right? Like, that's, it's just try. And we're not saying it is your responsibility as a reader. Like, you can be as lazy as you want. And, oh, look, the book marketing came, and the book marketing wants me to read this book, and, oh, it looks good, and look, there's a pretty table displayed up at the front of the store, and I'm just going to grab one of those, right? You are allowed to be lazy, but you're missing out.
Yeah, totally. There's actually a book, I'm trying to find it, there's a book on my to-read list that looks amazing. It is, it's a sci-fi novel by a Black author, and she, I think it's a she, just the cover, it looks like an African queen, but in space. And I'm really trying to find the title. It's like,
dude, these,
I know,
covers,
right?
These covers lately have been banging.
Like, really, like, right. I can't, I'm really trying to find it, but like, it was insane. And I was like, I have to read this book, because it is like, obviously it's going to be good. So it's in my to read list. And someday when either the library or my local bookstore is open again, because I think I need to like have it in my hot hands and not wait for shipping. It's going to get in there. It's just, anyway, I'll find it and I'll mention it again when I find it.
I saw some amazing pitches. We didn't record last week, but last week was, as of the time of this recording, when we're talking now, last week was Pit Mad, which is the pitch party on Twitter I talked about before. And there were some pitches that were so bomb that I was like, is this already a book? And I really felt that way. Any book that comps to Practical Magic, I'm in. But there was some really, really cool stuff. And I'm really excited to see the progress. Like, sometimes it's really cool to see a book and go, I never even thought of that before. And then 3 years later, it's on a shelf. So fingers crossed. Yeah. Fingers crossed. I saw some really cool stuff. I also saw some boring stuff, I'm sure. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I do like a little bit of a backwards thing where I see things that people are sharing, and it leads me to more people who I can follow,
yeah,
who then share lists that I can add to, who then, and it just kind of keeps going and going. And so again, like, I'm really consciously only putting in diverse books into my queue, because listen, my queue is like 500, 1,000 books. There's plenty of like non-diverse material in there also. So I might as well like throw in a bunch at the end. And then like, I kind of go through whatever's piqued my interest and pull something new and go and find it. So.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much out there. I've talked about this all the time when people are like, well, if they're only getting their books published, how weird. Like, there are actually people stupid enough to say, well, agents only want LGBTQ books or books by minorities. I'm like, are you serious? You think that that's true? Like, data does not reflect that that's true. And in fact, you should be like, there's room for everybody. There's room for everybody.
Or my second favorite is, oh, they just added that diverse element to sell. And I'm like, we've spoken to authors, and that is not the experience that they've had.
Yeah, the experience they've had is, in fact, the opposite. The experience they had is, why aren't you trying to sell my book based on how good it is? And instead, you're like, oh, would you like to be the token, you know, Hispanic panelist? Would you like to be the token Hispanic book and all the other books on that list? And you're only going to talk about the parts of your book that reflect your culture, and no one's going to ask you about your craft. Like, that's the experience that I see people having. And listen, when I'm watching a live thing from Jewish Book Council or Jewish Kidlit Zoom or webinar, I expect the authors to talk about incorporating Judaism when they're talking about Jewish, when it's offered by them. But if they're being offered up by a different group that isn't a Jewish group, and they're only asked to talk about the Jewish part of their book, I'm like, well, that's not, like, talk about how good it is. Ask them, like, about their craft, about their ability to write in first person, about how they did all the awesome historical research. But constantly asking them only, how did you incorporate your Judaism?
Or how did you get where you were today? It's like, well, you know, like, I'm sorry, you're not asking every author to talk about their life struggles to become an author. Like,
right.
You're just assuming that they'll be successful. You're assuming that they'll publish more than one book. So do the same for the diversity part of your panel, right? Assume that they are accomplished authors. Assume that if they have a story about their, like, struggle, they'll bring it up. But otherwise, like, just treat them like accomplished authors they are.
And by the way, that doesn't mean you're not allowed to highlight how awesomely diverse the book is. But if that's all you're doing, then you don't actually care about what's in the book. You're just, like, performing for people so that they can see that you really, really care.
Okay, I found the book that I was looking for. I've been, like, searching on the down low. It's called Binti. And it is about, it's by, oh gosh, I'm going to, it's Nnedi Okorafor. So I apologize for that. Like, that's pretty bad. So Binti has returned to her home planet, believing that the violence of the Medusa has been left behind. Unfortunately, though her people are peaceful on the whole, the same cannot be said for the Kosh, who fan the flames of their ancient rivalry. So it's a with Afrofuturist book is what they're putting it as. So it's, I mean, you have to see, and this is a different cover even than the one I saw, but it looks incredible. Like,
yeah. I'm excited. I'll borrow it from you when you're done. We'll trade.
Excellent.
Oh, the other thing, I was just thinking about this. The other thing that pisses me off about sometimes with the marketing, with quote, diverse book marketing, is mm-hmm. that instead of marketing the content of the book, they market the message.
Yeah.
And it scares people off.
Yeah.
It scares people
they
off.
Market the, like, audience.
What's up?
Well, they market the audience. Oh, yeah. You're a woman writer? How do you get men to read your book? And you're like, with their eyes.
Right. Like, I'm sorry. Like, can we market this just by, this was a really, really, really cool sci-fi book, as opposed to this was a book about female rage in space. I'm like, you know, just what, sometimes you can tell that what they're trying to do is narrow down their audience instead of expanding it.
Yeah.
And I don't get it.
Yeah. They think it has niche appeal, but that is not necessarily true.
Right. Although I will say that a lot of men, I don't see them reading a lot of female authors. Do you?
That is an interesting question. I don't know. I don't have enough men in my life who read to, like, really say, but I think that'd be interesting. Do the men in your lives read female authors on purpose or happenstance or not at all?
Or, like, do they even notice? Or are they looking at the blurbs? Are they picking up a book where the author's name is, like, Jennifer Sutherland or whatever? Are they like, oh, this book looks good? Or are they just automatically going past it?
So while I was Googling for the title of Binti, I came across, I did not know, I have a book on my shelf by an author who is a Black woman, but she goes by her initials, so I did not know. And I'm like, ooh. I'm excited. That's going to get bumped up the list because it just looked like any other book. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's N.K. Jemisin, the fifth season. And it's been on my shelf and I really do want to read it. And now I'm like, well, it's going to get bumped up now because it's not, and I hate to say it, but it's not just another book by a white male author. I'm hoping, you know, that, okay, that means that someone who's more like me, it might be more interesting to me. Instead of, like, the, you know, the usual male hero journey, the usual, like, tough guy story, like, the fact that it's a female author, and a Black female author maybe means that it's going to have more of that human element that I appreciate and more of the you know, the thrill and the chase and the fantasy, but with that, like, how do the people react and how do the characters grow and stretch? Like, I find that I'm more satisfied with the female authors than with the male authors in that aspect.
I do find that female authors definitely spend more time on character growth and also on the main characters being more self-aware of the way they are, the way they're seen when they walk into a room. Because women definitely, I feel like, walk into a room and are automatically thinking about what others are thinking about them.
You know, what's very funny, because I had a discussion about my dating life recently where I said, I need someone who has very high EQ. And I think that is really what that is that women tend to, and I'm not going to stereotype, but we value EQ, emotional intelligence, and we recognize it. And so when you walk into a room and you're reading the room and you're really like seeing, how am I presenting myself? How are these people there? Like, what, how do I fit? Like, that's what we do. That's like a very natural part of who we are. Mm-hmm. So we want to see that in our characters, right? You don't just like bumble it, unless it's, you know, they're further the plot, like they bumbled in and they didn't read the, you know, they didn't notice that they were getting death stares, you know. They sat down at the cool girls table and didn't notice they were getting the side eye, you know, like that's a plot driving device, but right. Not if your character keeps doing that, then we're not going to have sympathy,
right? At some point your character has to walk into the party, look around and realize they were lied to. This isn't a costume party. Oh crap. Yep. How, like, are people, like, what do I do?
I'm sorry. If you walked in and you got the up down, you think you would notice?
I would notice every up. I notice every up down.
Right? Like, yeah. Come on.
And by the way, have you ever walked into a large room where someone didn't up down you?
Yeah. So then you feel invisible.
Right. The fact is, if you're walking into a room and not one person looks from your ankles up to your face and then looks away, then it's like, oh, that's weird. I really am invisible. But then when they do, you're like super self-conscious, which is, again, you. We're super aware of how the room is relating to us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, because we're, when I go in, I don't know, it's like survival mechanism. You quickly scan the groups. You look for who's alone. You look for what the groups are. You look for the groups that are like where the body language is a certain way, because you can't just join any group. Like, everyone's got their arms closed and is making an angry face. That's not the group to just meander up to and be like, hey, so it's raining today. Like, you have to look for the group where they look warm and open. Like, we read a room, man. Yeah. It's our safety and our survival. It's really important for us.
You got to read a room. And I'm sure that there are men that do it more naturally. Like, they're not consciously doing it necessarily the way we do. Again, I don't want to generalize, because there's always generalizations that don't apply to everybody. And I'm sure we've met women who just barrel into every room that they're in. And you're like, you're just going to barrel in here? Like, you don't feel self-conscious at all?
But you and I have a shared love of reality television, and you and I know that we can spot the person who's reading the room and who, like, they know just the right thing to say to either stoke or calm the flames in that show. Yep.
Lisa Rinna on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, in every scene that she's in, when someone says something that you know is going to be featured on TV, it's going to be a huge moment, her eyes go real wide with excitement, like, ooh, this is going to be good. Yeah, like, that's, oh, you just said that thing. Like, she's super aware of what the producers are going to glom onto, and she'll immediately go, tell me more about that. Like, she gets the person to keep going, because she's like, this is, listen, if this person, if that line that they said is going to get featured, I got to get them to say seven more, right? Like, she gets real into it. And it's almost like she's doing the work for us. She's doing the Lord's work.
And it's funny, because I'm watching Love Island. I'm not going to admit how many seasons I've seen or whatever. Let's
not. I'll catch up.
Someone's like, oh, like, I could definitely see us being together. And you're like, oh, honey, your elbow is pointing at him and your knees are pointed away from him, and there is no way you are at all interested. And the fact that he is falling for it means he is not looking at you or really listening. He is staring at your chest and not really processing what's happening, because it is clear to me she is not interested.
You know, when you're watching reality TV, I actually think it's the same conversation I have with another friend of ours about Dungeons and Dragons, right? I don't play Dungeons and Dragons, but I know plenty of people who do. And no, they're not basement dwellers, okay? There is plenty of people playing Dungeons and Dragons because they treat it like just a board game, not because it's their life. They're not going out into the woods and reenacting it. And
I actually think you would like it because of the storytelling aspects.
Right, so that's what I was going to say is, I've described my characters to a D&D playing friend, and that friend was able to predict what they would do in my book and that I'd already written. He's like, yes. Oh, this thing happens. I'm like, how'd you know? And he's like, D&D, you can predict based on a character description what might happen next.
Yeah, it's fun because, you know, you and I are vociferous readers, voracious readers.
We're
vociferous.
Cruciferous readers, not cruciferous. Crustaceans.
Voracious.
Cumberbatch. I think the word is Cumberbatch.
Yes. Right. So we do that thing. And so I actually did play D&D for a couple of years. And it was funny because I was like, you mentioned that there was a door. That means you want us to go through that door. So that means I either don't want to go through that door. Like, you know,
yes.
We pick up the foreshadowing, we pick up the whatever, or like, you know, we know how to get it. I was like, what? I actually pulled a heist from, what's the movie with George Clooney where they, Ocean's 11. I pulled an Ocean's 11 with my team once to rob a guy in a space casino. So I was like, dude, I seen this movie. We can just do it. Do this. That guy hasn't seen the movie. We can just rob him now.
That's and brilliant. We did it. You know, it's a Chekhov's gun. You know the concept of Chekhov's gun?
It sounds familiar, but it escapes me right now.
It is a rule about plays, but also about books, about props on
the stage. You mentioned the gun, it needs to shoot within two acts. Yes.
So it's different, a little bit different in books than it is in a play. In a play, right, it needs to be used quickly. Otherwise, the audience is distracted staring at that gun on the wall. If there's a gun hanging on the wall and you don't use it within two acts, then the audience is not paying attention to your show anymore. They're wondering when someone's going to use the gun. If you put it in a book, it builds tension. Sometimes the longer you let that prop sit, and then they start to try to predict when you'll use it. Like, ooh, now that I know more about the characters, and now that I know that one of them has a gun, I wonder when and how they'll use it and how it'll come into play. Like, readers get real excited about trying to predict the outcome of Chekhov's gun. And if you don't use it, you're a jerk writer.
Okay, so I read A Blade So Black, which ooh. Is a retelling of Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, I want it.
I have it, I'll drop it by for you. And I'll tell you that there is a character named, so it's, it's Alice in Wonderland. So there's a lot of like-
Isn't it African-American, like girl? Yeah. Who's, okay.
Yes, so her name, so the author's name is L.L. McKinney. And her name is Alice. So there's a lot of like the mouse is Maddie and she's like a sleepy bartender. And there's little like tidbits from actual Alice in Wonderland. So there's a character named Chester, and I'm not going to give any spoilers, but the whole time I was like, oh, Chester works for the Queen of Hearts because it's a chess piece. And then I talked to a friend who I loaned it to, and she's like, oh, I thought he was supposed to be the Cheshire Cat.
That's where my mind went, was Cheshire.
Yeah. So again, I'm not going to spoiler, so I'm not going to, but it's funny how, you know, and I don't know if it was intentional, I'll tell you, because it was dropped so early. I was like, oh, I already got your number. I know who, of course, I did not predict who did it. I did not know who the bad person was. I did not predict as much as I thought I was going to. It still came out of nowhere for me. But it was fun for me to be like, oh, I know, I can tell, I see what you're doing here. Harry Potter was way too obvious for me. Like, I sat in the theater and like Lupin came on and I was like, oh.
Because the Scooby, it was a Scooby gang thing.
Yeah, he was she makes her names tell you who the person is.
Yes. Yes, that it's a little Star Wars-y like that. But yeah, it was a little Scooby-Doo like where it was like, pull the mask off. It was you the whole time, you know? So
I was also like, I'm sorry, if your name is Larry McBad Dude, and you're fighting like, you know, Eric Lightbringer, like,
Yeah.
Oh, who's the bad guy and who's the good guy there? You know, it's a mystery.
Yes. Well, this is actually interesting. This is, I was listening to a podcast called Dear Hank and John, or Dear John and Hank, depending on who posted it to SoundCloud that day, about from the brothers, Hank Green and John Green, both authors and Crash Course teachers, who are my Crash Course teacher heroes. If you ever need to learn a quick overview of a subject, or you need a student that is understanding something, just give them a Crash Course video about science or math or psychology or English or history, and they're fun to watch and they'll learn. So they were on their podcast talking about authorial intent, because one of the first videos that John Green ever made about literature was about the flashing light that Gatsby sees across the dock in The Great Gatsby, and how there was clearly authorial intent that the Gatsby light, the light symbolizes hope and the light symbolizes the American dream, blah, 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 blah. He goes, but then he became an author.
The car is green because I like green cars.
Right. And he started to realize that it's a mix and it's different for every book and it's different for every author, that sometimes you write a sentence in there where you're like, God, I hope the reader gets the intent of this sentence. I really, really hope they get the symbolism, and they don't, but they get symbolism from a sentence you wrote that you didn't have intention on. And he's changed his mind. He says, now I believe that instead of authorial intent doesn't matter. He says, what matters is once a person buys or takes a book from the library, it is their book.
Yes.
They get to interpret it whatever way they want to enjoy it, and you are no longer part of that book.
I made this claim to my English teacher in high school, and she was not impressed. So,
well, because in high school, the whole point of interpreting books is not to interpret the books, but to learn how to prove things.
Well, because I said that you don't know that the wall represented solidarity. And they were like, she was like, well, actually the author left journals. And I was like,
yeah. So I that happened to me once as a student, where I was supposed to, the book Sister Carrie, and I was supposed to write a thesis about it. And I wrote this whole thesis with an Adam and Eve thing. And the teacher's like, I don't agree with your thesis. And I said, but I proved it. And she was like, but I don't agree with it. This is in college. And I said, I don't care if you agree with it. The point of writing the paper is to prove your point. And I brought a lot of evidence in every paragraph. And she's like, but I don't agree. Then I went online and I found out that it turns out that was the author's intention the whole time. And I took it back to the teacher, and the teacher says, well, then how did I know you didn't plagiarize? And I'm like, well, God. Because if I nailed it on the head, that therefore it was a lose-lose. So I just wrote a new paper on a different pieces that I didn't agree with, because again, it's about proving, you're taking evidence and learning how to structure it into a paper, and not for any other reason, in my opinion.
I'll tell you that I am really good at really kind of following those clues and getting the intent and finding the red herrings and all that stuff, right? But in only my culture, and or in the cultures I'm aware of. So you know, I was watching some K-drama recently, and I've watched a couple now, and I just am kicking myself the whole time. Like, I really want to pop up video, because I feel like I'm missing all the nuance. I'm missing a lot of the turn of phrase.
You want to pop up video.
Yeah, I really want to pop up video to be like, oh, you know, and I was watching with somebody once who kind of knew part of it, like, ooh, she replied to him using the tone, the word choice you use when you talk to someone younger, but really he's older, and so that's a sign of disrespect. And then I was like, oh damn, I missed that whole thing. I didn't get it at all, because I'm not familiar. And all it made me want to do is do more. I'm like, well, now I just have to watch more, and now I have to do more research, and now I have to read along the show so that I can, you know, learn more, so that I can get it.
It's kind of like, have you ever read any Russian lit?
Not on purpose.
So the first time you read Russian lit, it's confusing if you're not Russian and you don't know how patronymics work and you don't know what common Russian nicknames are. So if you don't know that there's like 19 different nicknames for Alexander, and that you would use those different nicknames in different situations depending on if you're his father, if you're his brother, if you're his sister, if you're a friend, if you want to use his full name plus his middle name plus his last name, or maybe his patronymic, which is his father's name added to the middle. When would you use those situations? When would you use someone's title? It gets confusing, but you read a few of them, not confusing anymore. Suddenly it gets easy because you've practiced it. right? You read 4 or 5 and you're like, meh, I'm good now.
Right. So I guess the moral is don't give up.
The moral is don't give up, because when you give up and you're like, ugh, I like the book, but there's things I don't understand. Then you're now saying, forget this entire genre. I give up. I'm late. Like, I don't want to keep going.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny. Like, you know, there is an entire genre called what they call it, urban romance, which is just a code word for saying, you know, some of the characters are Black or some other person of color. And oh, well, you know,
wait, and it's called urban romance.
No, it's not great. I'm not gonna say I approve of that, but that's unfortunately what some places it's called. I hope that someone can say that they've changed that, but that's what it was in the library last time I was there. So yeah. Someone's like, well, I can't really relate to those stories. And I was like, oh, but you can relate to a woman finding love with a Scottish lord. That's relatable for you. Like, that's something that you have experience with personally. Like, finding a naughty duke who comes and like steals you and you have to marry him and turn him into an honest man, that's more realistic to you than, you know, a woman who lives in Chicago and, you know, like works in the publishing agency there and finds a man who, you know, knew her brother in college. Like, that's too outrageous, you know, like.
Right, that's too outrageous because they've shelved it under urban.
Right, you know, like, ooh, like, I just don't think I can relate to those characters. I'm like, she is a lawyer, like, there was one where she was a lawyer and he was, like, the public defender, and so they were, you know, sparks are flying, whatever. And you're like, okay, but the fact that they're Black means you cannot relate to them.
Apparently.
Like, let us go back over to the swashbuckling pirate who is, like...
So funny, because it's like, there's two things that are going on. On the one hand, someone will walk in and be saying, Dafka, I really, really, really want to find Jewish fiction. And you're really hoping that they've been shelved that way. But on the other hand, you don't want your Jewish fiction book to be only shelved in Jewish fiction, because then somebody scanning the YA shelves is not going to find your book.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And it becomes a problem. So it's bad. This is why people who work at a bookstore, booksellers, need to know the content of their store. So that when right. you're shelving your books and you're putting a Jewish young adult book on the YA section, and someone comes in and says, I really want to read a Jewish young adult novel, then you can be like, let me take you to the YA section and help you find it.
Because yeah, I know where it is. Cross-shelving, yes. Like you can cross-index, you know, I mean.
Yes, cross-index shelving is put a book in both sections, put one of each in both sections so that people can find it no matter what they're looking for. I think that booksellers definitely are instructed what to push, and sometimes they get an author come in and sell and sign a bunch of books, so it's really important for them to push the author signed copies, so that affects it sometimes, which is fine. That I understand. If an author's local and they come in and sign 50 books, great, and then the bookstore gets to up the price a little bit, that's fun. But yeah, booksellers definitely have an obligation to know what's on their shelves so that they can answer questions smartly and they can help shelf things appropriately.
Yeah, that's why I love having a relationship with either my librarian or my local bookstore, because you're more likely to get those kinds of recommendations.
Yes.
That's if you like to go and like touch a book like I do, but you could also, you know, you just need to know where to go online. Where so, you know, and again, you can be as specific as you want. I want to find a story about, you know, an Asian vampire who rides a dragon where, you know, whatever. Oh, okay. Well, we actually have 3 of those. Here are some options. Or you can just vaguely say, I really enjoy books that have like a bit of a mafia element, you know, or whatever. And they're like, well, have you read, you know, this Jade City? I can't think of her name. It is like a fantasy Asian island that has this complex martial arts magical mafia gang war thing going on. So, you know, like, yeah, after you read The Godfather, what you do read, maybe the Jade City. Like, I mean, right. You know,
they should be able to, especially now where it's curbside pickup in a lot of places. Although I heard a rumor that there's Barnes and Nobles here that are open.
Oh.
Maybe not in our county, maybe in the county next door to us. I saw an author from, I believe King County, posting that the Barnes and Noble near her was opening and she could go in and browse.
So the experience I have is that I will not get a personalized recommendation in a Barnes and Noble.
No, I will not. I don't prefer another
person in the bookshelf.
Yeah. No, I agree. And it's so big that browsing a store that large right now, when you can't like just plop down onto a couch in the store and look through the book because you have to keep moving, it's not really the best time. Like, I'd rather go into a smaller bookstore where I'm going to get more personal attention. You're right.
Yeah. 100%. Because you can even call them, right? You can't really call Barnes and Noble and be like, here's what I'm looking for, but you can call your local bookstore. Or even our librarians, where we are, you can text them 5 books and they'll text you back 5 different books.
That's true. It's really a lot about us and the reader. Listen, if we're going to believe, let's tie it all together. We're going to believe that authorial intent doesn't matter once the book gets into your hands, that the book is about what you make of it. And if we're going to believe that message books, it's just about the marketing. There's no such thing. It's just about enjoyment, right? You can get a message from it, but you might get a different message than the other person, or you might look at the marketing and go, why'd you market it that way to me? It was just a really fun fantasy novel. I don't see anything about social justice in here, right? Like, or you might think the opposite. I wasn't told this was going to be a book about, you know, equity. Like, I
actually like books that have multiple levels. And I've mentioned this before, like Terry Pratchett books, they're absurdist. Right. You can read the social justice or the, it's not even just social justice. I mean, he tackles all kinds of political ideology, just all kinds of stuff, but you don't have to. You could just be like, dang, those wizards are weird. And that witch is crazy.
I know the book I'm writing right now that I'm revising right now, you could read it and be like, wow, anti-Semitism, huh? Or you could read it and be like, oh, it reminds me of Buffy. Like, that's
right. Exactly.
Which honestly, I'd rather. Like, it'd be nice if someone read it and was like, wow, I didn't know. But like, there were no vampires. This is a fantasy. Like, there's nothing to know. Like, you know, it's not all metaphor. Sometimes it's just because I thought it was clever. I don't want to leave too much of a record of what my intent was, because I like what John Green was saying about authorial intent not really mattering. Like, let somebody just enjoy the book. And take from it what they take from it, and not, you know, don't take what you don't want to take and just move on and get another one.
That's it. And I think we've talked before about how the more specific you are, the easier it is to connect things.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and I think I like your example of, you know, she went home and fixed herself, you know, a bowl of soup is not the same at all as she went home and, you know, fixed herself up, you know, a bowl of pho, or a bowl of matzo ball soup, or a bowl of pozole.
Or even more specific, she always kept matzo ball soup from her mom in her freezer, and she took out a tub and defrosted it in the microwave and heated it up in a paper bowl, right? Like, once you start getting nuance and specifics, you're like, yeah, I would do that.
Right. That's exactly, you know, that's exactly how it works.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there were girls at work. I know, my parents do this to some extent, is like, oh, your parents left, so your freezer's full now, right? And she's like, yeah.
See, that's so nuanced and specific. This idea that there's something recognizable in that, right? Like, there's nuance in there, as opposed to just like, we had steak for dinner. Right? Like, why are you telling me this?
Yeah, that's not important. No, if you say she took, you know, her father seared his steaks with the family brand, you know, as he did every time he barbecued.
Yeah, you know, she got him for Father's Day 8 years before, and she didn't know he was using.
You know, he wore the Kiss the Chef, you know, apron. Like, listen, like, those details make it so much.
Yes, they make it everything charming, and you can start seeing the better books really have that, and they make you smile, and they make you go, yes. Right. And they really make you relate to it and go, oh my God, when I was a teenager, I totally thought this stupid way. You know, I was as irrational as that main character is being right now. Oh my gosh, I was such an idiot. Right. Like, to really see yourself in the universality of a book. So, like, once now you've got authorial intent doesn't matter. It's all about you, the reader. We're trying to give you recommendations of books that are just really, really, really like going to appeal to you. That's when you get on the phone with the librarian and you're like, this is how I want to feel when I read a book. That's a good way to make a request.
Yes, I like that. I like that a lot.
Yes.
Because often, you know, I read a book the other day. It was a Nora Roberts book called Shelter in Place. and it was a mistake.
Yeah.
But then it was not a mistake. So have you read that one?
No, but the title makes me think it's a mistake.
Yeah. So I'm literally sitting on the couch and a dog jumped in my lap and I finished my novel and I was like, oh no, I literally can't move because there's a puppy sleeping on me. So now what do I do? And I looked over, I'm like, oh, there's this book someone loaned me. And I started reading it and then I bawled for 2 hours because it's about a mall shooting and the survivors afterwards. And there's a bit of like a serial killer mystery. And there's, you know, obviously a love story and this and that, because it's Nora Roberts. And I was like, this book is so great. If I had known that I would cry for 2 hours when I read it, I would never have picked it up because I do not like crying. Crying is not a pastime. Crying is not a hobby of mine. Everyone's like, oh, I watched This Is Us and I just cried the whole time. I'm like, okay, that sounds great for you. I'm not going to do that.
I will pass on the crying while I read the thing.
Pass.
I don't mind closing the book and going, I'm going to look off into the distance and think of how amazing that book was. But I do not want to be crying while I'm doing it. Right? Like, that's a rule. I'm like, nope, pass. I cry enough when I watch TV. I do not want to be crying when I'm reading a book.
I loved it, but I love the book. And so I like that I was almost tricked into reading it and then hijacked by a dog. Because I really, really did enjoy it. It was an excellent book. And, you know, again, character development, even the serial killer, you were like, wow, I see why you are who you are. And I see why you made the choices you're making. And like, I mean, it was just, I really did enjoy it. But I honestly would not have picked it up.
When a book is bad, some of the reasons a book is bad is when the characters keep changing personalities.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
They don't have any. Or they don't have any personality.
Or they don't have any personality. When you get to a point where you're like, why would he say that? That person would never say that. Like, I'm sorry. You cannot tell me that this person does this job for a living and he's using that kind of sentence. Like, that's weird. You're confounding expectations in a bad way, right? Like, when you start to anger the reader by not caring at all about your characters, we can tell.
Or you haven't done any background research or like met any of the kinds of people you're trying to represent, like brushing curly hair, men writing women boobily, like all of these things make me go, could you just not? Like, I'd rather you write an entire book of people who are you than do this because you did this person wrong. Like, this character
I'm gonna say something and it's gonna be trigger warning nasty. In 50 Shades of Grey, there is a scene where Gray, or whatever his first name was, pulls a tampon out of the girl.
I'm making a face.
Okay. Now, here's the reason it's weird. It's
like a puckered belly button.
Right. First of all, I believe a woman wrote this. But secondly, the way that she's standing when he does it, it's impossible that he could possibly pull it out of her body. That's not a position that women stand in that's a thing. Like, it was impossible. And I just thought, first of all, A, why would you write that? That's bad. But B, this is like, as I'm reading it, I'm like, nope, this is more unrealistic than her having an inner goddess monologue. And we can tell. We know, listen, we know this is written as fan fiction. We know it's poorly written, but we like the story. We know we read it anyway because it's fun smut. It is fun smut. We know that the message is terrible, that the only reason he's into what he's into is because he was abused as a kid, not because he's genuinely into it. And that she can save him even though he gaslights the crap out of her. We know all these things are bad, but people bought it because it was like a smutty read and they ignored the stupidity of that tampon scene and the inner goddess. If sometimes a book doesn't have to be good.
Yes. I can recommend many, many bad books that are fun to read if someone wants that.
Yes.
I have plenty where I'm like, oh, like I just read one. It was again, the Duke and the something. And he turns to her and says, you've got great tits. And I was like, I'm sorry. I don't think that they spoke like that. Thank you very much.
You know, I have to be careful when I'm writing because my book is set in the late 1800s and I keep wanting to have them say the words okay.
Mm.
But like, they speak Hungarian. So There's, and they live in a shtetl. They probably wouldn't have had that in their vernacular. They speak Yiddish in Hungary. They probably wouldn't have been like, okay, no problem.
You're right. Right. Yeah.
So I keep wanting to do that. So I'm not writing that kind of book. I'm not writing the kind of book where I don't care about my reader at all. I'm just going to write whatever the hell I want. I actually care. And so, yes, sometimes books are bad, but you want them anyway. And sometimes they're bad and you throw it across the room.
Correct.
Ugh. Correct. You know, the ultimate DNF means do not finish of a book is when you take the bookmark out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. You know, like I have, you know, it looks like I have 12 books that I'm currently reading in Goodreads, but a couple of them, I'm like, at what point do I just give up and say, I'm not going back to finishing it? There's a, like, you know, if I cared, I would figure out a way to finish reading it. Right. Like,
yes.
You know, I think I just gotta move on.
I have a few books like that. Like, I would say like five. I think there's total. Like, I'm really a book finisher. So if I DNF a book, if I pull out that bookmark, it's rage. It's,
oh yeah.
I'm mad. I'm mad that I was betrayed. I'm mad that I was promised the bill of goods and not delivered.
So I'm upset. Like, you know, I talked before about how I was reading an ARC that I got on NetGalley, and I wanted to give feedback on an anti-Semitic trope that was being used. And so I reached out to the publisher and I reached out to the author and I never heard back. And, you know, and so I rage DNF that one. Like, I'm not going to finish it. I need to write a scathing review and just say, I didn't finish this book. I couldn't get past this anti-Semitic trope in the end.
Right.
You know, but otherwise the writing was wonderful, you know, until the anti-Semitism came out.
And no one cares about anti-Semitism, you neat. It's so sad because it's true.
Yeah. You know, and I even did that thing that women do where I was like, oh my gosh, the book, thank you so much for the opportunity. And it was such a great read, except for this one bit. And I tried to, like, you know, build. And then I was like, ooh, except for this, it's problematic element over here.
Right.
You know, I didn't go in guns blazing.
If the reason you're sending out an ARC is twofold. One is you want to get early reviews, but two is you want to make sure you didn't do something glaringly stupid that you could easily change before it goes to print in the final copy. And so being told, hey, this plot point didn't work, this chapter was slow, I stopped reading it, there was an anti-Semitic thing in there that didn't match the book or the characters, it was weird, like out of context, I don't know why it was there. Being told that in advance is like winning the lottery, because you're like, oh, thank God I found out beforehand that I did something bad for my career or bad for my book's sales, because people are going to read this and go, I don't like this. But if you could find out which part they didn't like and rewrite it, people think that that's a big deal. It's not a big deal. Do you know how often a writer rewrites their book before they even submit it to their editor? And then how often they rewrite it again after that? It's uncountable.
And I'll tell you that if the problematic element of your book is so integral to the book that it makes it difficult to rewrite, then there's more problems that you should have caught.
That's true. Yes. If it's a major plot point that you can't get around, then you have a bigger problem than just, oh, I had one trope in there that was bad.
Right. If you can smooth over, like, this character really didn't have to be anti-Semitic. They could have been just kind of literally anything else.
Right. Easy. But if it's like the whole premise of your book is that he was a Nazi until he met a really pretty Jew.
You're not like other Jews because you're pretty.
And now all my neo-Nazism is fading. It is a miracle that I fell in love with you.
Your magic panties have saved my soul.
They've saved me. I'm no longer hateful. And at the end, she converts to Jesus.
Love has conquered all.
Love overcomes hate, because he should have overcome hate anyway, but he couldn't because he hadn't met anyone with blue eyes who was Jewish yet.
Yes. But yes. You know what? Women need to be more free about who we give our love to, because we don't know if we could be making the difference between someone being a Nazi or not.
That's true. We should try to go out there and, you know, hook you up, Yoni, with some neo-Nazis. That's
not what I'm looking for currently.
No, we'll get you on an app. Well, I'm sure they have a thing to get.
But you know, give me a little more. So I'll tell you, here's a funny story. So I live near a little free library, and there is a vampire Christmas romance sitting in there. And I generally don't like the Christmas edition of a series. There's every series has a Christmas one, right? Like, right. And usually I don't like it because it's like, listen, Christmas is really crammed down my throat. I don't really don't need it, you know, anyway. But I keep saying one day I'll be so desperate for something to read, I will read the Christmas vampire romance. So, you know, I'm not currently looking to transform some icky, horrible man into a prince, but, you know, give it some time and maybe we'll see.
You know, I'm bad at intentional puns. I have to really think about them. Like, I'm not one of those people who can do a pun off. If I can come up with a really funny pun right now for a Nazi youth dating app, like... It's like that scene in Never Have I Ever where they're trying to come up with apps that will help someone during the war. Like, it was like a teacher's project. Did you see this show yet?
I didn't see through it. I have the crippling empathy where when the scene where she is telling her friend that she's dating the hot guy, I was like, no, you're not. Oh God, I'm going to die. I can't.
Oh, was that great? No, so this is a scene where the teacher assigns them to come up with an app that would have been useful during World War II. And the Jewish guy, his group comes up with a bunch of apps, and one of them, the one they decide on is Juber, or that's what they're going to go with, but they decide to change their minds because they're like, wait, so what you're saying is you want an app where to escape the Nazis, a car will come and pick up Jews, but they'll be on a map so everyone will be able to identify where their location is. And he's like, yeah, maybe it's a bad idea. But on the board behind him are other ideas that are crossed out. And one of them is Twitler.
Oh, God.
To be honest,
can you imagine? You've seen the propaganda films and flyers and stuff. So an entire social media platform for German propaganda seems like it probably would have existed.
Are you kidding me? That's Twitter a lot. Okay. There are days when I'm like.
Just Google Twitter.
Yeah, there are days when I'm like, I really just want to talk to other writers. Can the Nazis stop, like, tweeting at me and stop being, like, you know, sending me weird memes or, like, DMing me pictures of their scrotums? I'm really not in the mood. Like, and that's just one week where no one says anything royally, royally anti-Semitic and super Nazi-like on Twitter. Just one. So yes, I can imagine what Twitter would look like. But yeah, so if I could come up with a pun to have Yonit heal some sort of neo-Nazi. See, the face that you're making is why this shouldn't be in a book.
Oh my God. Yeah, don't do it. No.
Although, a book about a woman who on purpose goes out there and deliberately tries to date neo-Nazis so that she could be like, ha ha, you slept with a Jew.
Ooh, entrapment,
except then she'd be sleeping with him. I don't like that.
Well, part. Also a trap is anyway, I'm going to see myself out.
You know, we haven't even had a drink.
I know. I want people to know that even when we do drink alcohol, it's not really creating any of the situation that happens afterwards.
This is evidence that the really dumb stuff that comes out of my mouth has absolutely nothing to do with
unrelated. In fact, it probably is better because if I get a little tipsy, then the neurons don't always connect to something, and then I just kind of move. Like I get, oh, shiny, I forget what I'm saying.
Right. The dumb stuff is a result of connecting the dots. It is a result of saying, on the Bloom's taxonomy, it is the result of synthesis, right? Mm-hmm. When we get to the synthesis stage is when we start to connect multiple dots, and then we come up with interesting apps like Juber.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Like, okay, so you got the Holocaust, you got Jews, you got Uber, right? Like, you're synthesizing until you get something comes out of your mouth. You're like, that was stupid. That should not have been said out loud. But I thought of it. Why did I think of it? Because I put all these dots together. But I didn't, right? You can't put all those dots together when you're drunk.
Nope. It's probably for the better.
What was the topic of this podcast, Yonit?
We, I think, said, hey, let's just talk and see what happens.
Let's just talk about alcohol and see what happens. And it turns out exactly the same.
Very, very much the same. We did talk about stretching yourself to read authors, genres, and topics that you wouldn't normally pick up.
Yes.
You know, you could go safely and just find something that's tangentially similar to something else you like.
Yes.
Dip your toe into it.
Dip your toe into a genre, culture. If you don't normally read a historical because you haven't tried them, not because you've tried them and didn't like them, but you just haven't tried them yet.
Right. Well, even if you tried something and didn't like it, we talked about, like, there's hundreds and hundreds of examples. Yeah. So if you didn't like that historical novel, then what was it that you didn't like? And then there are other authors or other series that maybe don't have that thing you didn't like.
Right. And now, while I don't think any men are listening to our podcast, maybe, if you are a man and you're listening, I assume that's, you're a person that reads more than just Clive Cussler. So
not if you're a Nazi.
If you're a Nazi, please don't DM us.
Right.
Especially don't DM us your scrotum.
Definitely double on that one.
Double down on that request. This is why we
normally read Clive Cussler. What would you recommend to them?
For people who only read Clive Cussler?
Yeah.
What would you recommend to someone to pull them slowly away from only reading books like Clive Cussler? That's a really good question. What do you think, Yonit?
So I'll say that a reasonable, like, parallel mm-hmm. could get maybe the Temperance Brennan series. Bones is the TV show, but Temperance Brennan is the character. The series is written by, Anyway, so she's a forensic anthropologist. She solves crimes. It's Kathy Reichs is the author. Ugh, I've read all of them, so that was silly. But it's the similar kind of, there's a mystery that's solved in the book. It's solved through a mixture of forensic clues, good old fashioned police work. There's some international aspect because she goes between Canada and North Carolina in the books. And so there's sometimes that international aspect where there's some, like, I think one of the books, like, very heavily featured a culture that is similar to the Creole of the South of America, but it's in Quebec. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember the exact, like, what it was. And it features very strongly. So they had to figure out, like, oh, well, the clues point to this community and we have to figure out, you know, why people are disappearing. I don't know. It was a whole thing. So she has a lot of different kinds of topics. It's not just your victim of the week. And I enjoy those. So if you like the mystery of those, I think that might be a place to go.
I think that's a good place to start for someone, because a lot of times men will say, to me at least, the reason they like to read books that have male main characters is because they can identify with them. And I always reply with, yes, but I read books with male main characters and I'm a female, and I read books with children and teenagers and women with, like, who are in their 70s and people who are not Jewish. Like, it's just about enjoying the book.
Or the main character's a vampire or a werewolf.
Right. Men, I've asked my husband about this, and he said he likes, in movies and in books, most of the time, to imagine, it's like fun, this is how men, or at least him, this is how he has an imagination, is he gets to insert himself into the story. What would I do in that story? What would I do if I was that character? And it's easier for you to do that if you can picture actually that the character is you. Whereas when I read it, I'm not going, what would I do if I was that character? I'm drawn in by the character and letting the character be in charge and seeing what they'll do next. I'm not trying to use that as an outlet for my imagination.
Right. I think it is interesting this, like, to imagine what would that character do. Like, right. I'm not going to make those same choices. Like, I'm not going upstairs if I hear a noise. Right. I'm not going to look in the basement with a flashlight.
Right.
I will definitely not do that.
When I read The Da Vinci Code, I'm not sitting there thinking, wow, if I was him, then I would do this. Like, that's not what's going on in my head. So, but apparently for him, for my husband, that's what's happening when he's reading it. And so that's what makes it, for him at least, more difficult to read books that have main characters that aren't, like, adult males.
That's
limited. And that's why he doesn't read vampires. Like, he's like, I'll read any adult male. If you're an adult male and you're the lead of a book, it doesn't matter what race or religion or culture you are, as long as you're an adult male and it's easy for me to put myself in your shoes. But if you're a vampire male or a dragon or something, it's not happening anymore.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Are you saying Lestat is not like a 700-year-old male? He is about as adult male as you can get.
You know, I don't think he liked those books.
But any of them, like, they're still adult men. They just are, like, extra adult. They do date teenagers, oddly, but that's
true. Those books do what Twilight does, which is humanize the vampires into the point where it's like reading a person as opposed to making them into demon villains.
Yeah. So I don't know.
Right. But, so I guess I understand. It's kind of like on Buffy where we started to see Angel and Spike as people as opposed to as vampires. We can no longer picture them getting staked.
Yeah.
Right, but the vampire that pops out of the cemetery, we don't know that guy. He can.
Yeah, we don't know you. We can kill you. It's fine.
It takes 2 seconds. Boom, boom, he's gone. But yeah, if you're a man and you're trying to expand it, I would actually argue that if you're a man and you're trying to expand your palette, don't go, what's similar to what I read? Try something that's not even remotely similar to what I read. Like, yeah, pick up a Philippa Gregory book and read about the Tudors.
That is going to be very different.
I'm curious. I'm actually going to challenge my husband to do this, is to take the Anne Boleyn book and read a Philippa Gregory book.
Interesting.
I will report back.
Well, I'll tell you that a lot was different. The pacing, the character development, like that, I was going to say, how far away could you get from a Clive Cussler book? And that's right. Pretty much it. I mean,
right. And it's not like, Big Little Lies, one of those where it's like a women's fiction book club book. This is a historical, but it is a historical featuring women.
Yes. Right. I enjoyed that. Yeah.
And it's got intrigue and it's got sword fights. It's got intrigue. It's got plotting, but it's got the females doing it.
Right.
Right. So that's the question, is it's far away, but it's not so far away that Reese Witherspoon would recommend it.
Are you sure? Because I thought that the other Boleyn girl did make it onto lists at some time.
Maybe I'll go with something a little less. No, I'm in. I'm giving that to him. I'm going to see what happens. And next time we record, I'm going to report back and he's going to be obligated because I just said it on the podcast.
Excellent. I like how that goes. And listeners, if you're going to do the same challenge and challenge yourself to read something that's outside your comfort zone, report back. Like, I'm curious.
Yes.
Like, what does it feel like when you're consciously doing something that makes you somewhat uncomfortable? And how does it affect your enjoyment or your interest? And does it get you in deeper? Or are you like, well, that was interesting and I'm never doing that again?
I love it. That's a great way to wrap up, Yoni, is to give people a challenge. Let's do it, guys. Tell us how it goes. And if you're looking to find us on Instagram, Kiddish Book Club.
Yep. And we are both on Twitter and Goodreads and, you know, various other places. I'm Yoni DM in all of those places.
And I'm Hoffman Jess or Jessica Hoffman on Goodreads. And I, you know, can't wait to see you on Twitter or on Instagram and let us know and DM us what you're reading.
Yeah. And you have to consciously choose to read something different. So
yes.
Get out there.
This is the weekly challenge. We'll put it in the show notes on Spotify so you can see that it's in the challenge so you can tell other people. And thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you. Have a good one.
Have a good one.
Ooh, Elokeinu, ooh, Avinu, ooh, Malkeinu, Moshiinu. Ooh, Elokeinu, ooh, Avinu, ooh, Malkeinu, Moshiinu. Ooh, Elokeinu, ooh, Avinu, ooh, Malkeinu, Moshiinu.